The morning after Elaine's rescue, the Winter Court arrives to bolster the numbers of the Prithian army. Both Feyre and Mor make amends in light of the danger to their lives. News of the Hybern army's movement toward the human territories spurs Feyre, Rhysand, and the other High Lords into action, exhausting their powers to save as many humans as possible before the inevitable destruction from Hybern's army. But desperation has Feyre pushing to further extremes in order to ensure her loved ones live past the final battle.
The views expressed by the hosts are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author. This podcast is a discussion shared to spark thought and conversation on characters and themes of this novel.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series spoilers may be discussed with or without warning. Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, death, and depression, will recur throughout the podcast. Listener discretion is advised. Thank you to all our Patreon supporters, with a special shout out to our May 2023 Tropy Wives. Thank you, Laren, Amani, Catherine, Shannon, Diana, Veronica, Anne, Jackie, Trisha, Kelsey, Violet, Kelly, Jen, Nicole, Kathleen, Amelaide, Jessica, Helen, Danica, Carissa, Sylvie, Sierra, Colleen, Haley, Alexa, Sam, and Allison. To learn more about how to become a Tropy Wife, visit patreon.com/booktalkforbooktalk.
Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels.
This season, we're exploring Sarah J. Maas's most ambitious novel in the Court of Thorns and Roses series.
This is Jack.
And I'm Amy.
This week, we're discussing chapters 66 through 69 in A Court of Wings and Ruin.
This week, we ask ourselves, how are the truths revealed in this section influencing the reader?
Themes we see this week include strengths and weaknesses.
Feyre awakens in the Prithian camp at the start of chapter 66. The first thing she thinks of after the night before, the night she and Azriel saved Elaine from the Hybern camp, is Tamlin.
I love that she just wakes up and the first thing she thinks of is like, Tamlin!
Like, yeah, it's kind of like, oh!
Yeah, like a drunken night, like, oh no, did I make a mistake? Okay, cool, no.
Yeah.
You just saved my life.
It's true.
Feyre realizes that Tamlin was actually a spy the whole time, and the way that she thinks about it is almost as if she was like, whoa, of course he was a spy the whole time. But no, she didn't realize that, obviously. And I just love that Tamlin makes his whole life more difficult by not telling a single person that he's actually a spy.
But does that make him a good spy? Because no one knows if he's a spy?
Unless he's like spying just, he's like probably just waiting to see who wins.
And then he's like, okay, I'm on that side.
I was a spy the whole time.
The first page of this chapter is Feyre really trying to sort through her thoughts on Tamlin and reconciling all that she knows about him. It ends with two thoughts that are worthwhile to note. First, the wind Tamlin used to save Feyre was a power he'd never used before around her. Second, Feyre equates Tamlin saving her to the story of Nefel from the war 500 years ago, that the most unlikely person can alter the course of history, as Azriel once said. Or, as Feyre thinks of it, the weakest link in the plan made at the High Lord meeting, being Tamlin, turns out to be essential to her survival.
I love how we can view Tamlin being like Nefel, and you can kind of see it in two different ways. So I think it can also be read as Feyre thinking that Tamlin was her weakness rather than Tamlin's weakness. And let me go a little bit more into that. The only reason why I'm doing that is because I think it's always fun to appreciate two different point of views. First way of saying this is that Tamlin is the weakness. He is Nefel, the metaphorical one, obviously. And even though he is the weakest link out of every High Lord there, his strength is what helped in the end. The second way of looking at this is that Feyre is reflecting on her weaknesses and Tamlin was her weakness. And that turned into a strength because he saved her. It's just a matter of who's the main character in this interpretation, but I think it's fun just to look at it in two different ways.
Yeah, because we don't actually understand or know for sure which way Feyre's thinking about him.
She does that a lot in this section.
She does.
And we'll talk about that later, but
this section could have been revised a little bit more.
I agree. I agree with that. We should talk to her editor.
We'll get into it.
Yeah.
Feyre isn't fully able to process everything about Tamlin. And I think that lends itself to why she's not very clear about what she's thinking. What's most important, though, is that Feyre knows if Tamlin had not been at Hybern's camp, Feyre would have died.
Oh, yeah. And it's heavy. Like, let's appreciate this for a moment. SJM knows what she's doing here. Tamlin ended up being integral for this story, and he's not done saving people. Like, he's going to save Rhys later.
And so when people ask us about a Tamlin redemption arc, the groundwork is being laid. He's not worthy of goodness, maybe, but if he was not going to get a redemption arc, he would not play this role.
Exactly. And I know it bugs so many people, and it's like, I'm sorry, like, we're just here to tell you how we're interpreting it. Yeah. SJM could be easily like, this was it. This was his redemption arc.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. She's like, this is enough.
Yeah.
He can suffer the rest of his life. And I would be fine with that, too.
Exactly. Like, you know, we're here for the ride, guys. But, you know, from what we're seeing, it's going to be a redemption arc.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
What this sequence is telling me is that SJM has used the story of Nifel as a metaphor for Tamlin in a way that requires us as readers to rethink Tamlin's role in this story. That's exactly what Feyre is trying to do as well. I want to bring up Tamlin's wind power again. It's a power he's not outrightly used before. Could it be that, like Feyre in Velaris during Mist and Fury, the strength of Tamlin's emotions and feelings in the situation at Hybern spurred on stronger powers than he's ever used before? Because if that's the case, that is very, very telling about Tamlin's intentions here.
I have a great point that I'm about to make, but before then, you said Tamlin's wind power, and I just imagine him as a big old wind turbine, like his hands rotating.
I fully expected you to say him farting. His farts are propelling him.
I mean, it is, for whatever reason, it's like rose-scented spring court. Every time Rivera felt the wind kiss her cheeks. Wow. I just want everyone to know it's early and the caffeine hasn't kicked in.
It's true.
So I'm going to say that this is the first time Tamlin wanted to use his powers. And I know that statement sounds a little off the mark, but allow me to go on, please. We know Tamlin never wanted to be High Lord. It was something he did not want or work towards. It was just that he was super powerful compared to his brother, so it went to him. And then they're all dead, so, you know, that also helps. But then strength started to represent being a High Lord, and he resented being a High Lord, and we saw that all the time in Thorns and Roses. Mm-hmm. Like, he did not want that. Even under the mountain, Tamlin never fought for Feyre. When it was time to attack Amarantha, he used his teeth and claws instead of his magic. I don't think Tamlin has ever really pushed himself magically to discover his true High Lord powers, especially since in the past, Amy and I have talked about him being one of the weaker of the High Lords. He doesn't winnow. He doesn't do much. He shapeshifts, but it's not all that fancy, right? He should be able to do more. For the first time, Tamlin wanted to use his powers, and he was able to summon the wind. Another option we can look at that is, like, he's always been able to summon the wind, and we have to go back to Thorns and Roses and see every single time that the wind kissed Feyre's cheek, and maybe it was Tamlin, but that sounds like work that I will not be doing.
So, one point you made that I want to clarify, Tamlin is capable of winning, but chooses not to winnow.
Oh, is he? Does he?
Yeah. He's capable of winnowing.
Oh, you're right, because he was able to winnow. Yeah, you're right.
But he doesn't winnow far, he can't winnow a lot of people with him, and most of the time he'd rather ride a horse.
Or be the horse. But yeah, he's never come across as the most powerful of the crew. When, if you look at someone like Tarquin, who only got the job because everyone else died.
He still winnowed his army.
Yeah, like
just Tamlin, like Rhys.
Tamlin has potential. And then there's that theory that, like, you and I think that the manor that we see isn't the actual Spring Court home base.
Mm-hmm. It's just one of the estates his family has.
Yeah, it's a manor.
Yeah.
If I was pretending to be, like, Feyre pretending to come back after, like, you know, being the high, like, at the beginning of the book, be like, you know, the Court of Nightmares was much bigger than this, I'm just saying.
The last thing I will say about Tamlin before we move on, and then, dear listener, you can purge your thoughts of Tamlin for a while,
mm-hmm.
is that Tamlin ultimately fought for Feyre here. Something he never did under the mountain when Amarantha was alive. Something we didn't get to see him really try to do in Mist and Fury, except to fuck things up. And that is a parallel that Tamlin, when it has mattered with Highburn, has fought for Feyre. And that's an important distinction.
Because he never fought for her before.
Nope.
That's beautiful. Now to happier thoughts, like Asriel's traumatic childhood.
Despite being treated by a healer, Feyre isn't in the best shape after her showdown with Highburn the night before. When Feyre thinks of Asriel and his wounds and how she doesn't know how he managed to fly despite his injuries, Feyre stops and thinks, quote, I didn't let myself think about how and when and why Asriel had learned to manage pain like that. I point this out not because you need to be reminded about how Asriel has suffered throughout his life and has therefore built up an insane tolerance to pain. I point this out because this is a good reminder to me that, in general, our past demons can influence our present and how we handle life, which is a very applicable thought to both real life and to each of the characters we've encountered in this book.
And in the same chapter, we're about to find out how much more pain he's suffered emotionally with what Moore has actively, knowingly done. And, you know, the real question that we should have asked ourselves is how much can Daddy Azzy hurt? Because it's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
We recently talked about this in a mini episode, and I don't know if this is coming before or after that mini episode. But my theory is Asriel's good at being a spymaster, not just because he's a shadow singer, but because he's had so much pain inflicted upon him in his life. And because of that, he's not only good at withstanding pain in dire situations, he's also really good at torturing others for information because he has to vent all that trauma that's been inflicted on him. Feyre goes out looking for food for her sisters. Quote, Elaine was likely starving, and I doubted Nesta had eaten anything during the hours we'd been gone. Feyre doesn't bother to get food for herself despite the camp mother's insistence that Feyre also eat. This is a very clear reminder that Elaine and Nesta are weak, being without food, but so is Feyre right now. This is also a huge callback to Thorns and Roses for me. Feyre is prioritizing feeding her sisters, just like when they were human. Feyre's not doing it out of a need to survive, though. She's doing it out of love.
It's such a callback, but it's also showing the difference because back in the human world, there wasn't anyone to really worry about Feyre and what she's eating. And then here, now that she's freaking High Lady of Fae and the Night Court, there's a camp mother who looks out for her. It shows that Feyre was meant to be Fae all along. SJM has received some backlash before for insensitivities, and I'm going to point them out here in a moment. When the Winter Court arrives, Feyre looks at the military and says, quote, the Lesser Fae. He brought more lesser fairies than any of us, if you excluded the Illyrians. So here are three different ways to interpret this. One, the Winter Court is so open that they allow the lesser fae to be in the military. Two, there's not enough higher fae because they all died from Amarantha. Or three, the Winter Court believes that the lesser fae's lives are worth risking. And I think that it's a valid thought process for some readers, especially because Kalias later on will say that saving humans is a waste of time. Just something to think of. But now for me to go more into the insensitivities. Feyre is a bit horrified or happy. Like, again, we can't quite tell what she's feeling in this moment that Kalias brought so many lesser fae. But the insensitivity part for me comes from the part where Feyre says, more lesser fairies if you excluded the Illyrians. And I know there's some people who are going to say that it's nitpicking, but we're analyzing. That's what we're supposed to do. And I'm just also trying to be aware of things of like why people could interpret what SJM says as just not the best. I mean, you and I have talked before, Amy, about like we don't really like how the Illyrians are interpreted. We don't, I mean, obviously, like, there's no specific race. We just know that they're darker brown skin, and they're kind of, like, backwards and brutish. Mm-hmm. And I don't appreciate that at all. By saying, if you don't include the Illyrians, she's excluding the Illyrians, making them even more other than they already are. So why wouldn't Feyre include the Illyrians? And I can already hear some people saying, because the Illyrians don't count themselves as lesser fae. Like, there's a whole other section, possibly, for them. But I get it. I'm just saying that this is not a well-written moment because I don't know what Feyre is feeling when she's looking at this army.
I'm glad you brought this up. And I know that this is a topic for many people. I think any fan of SJM can confidently say SJM is not malicious.
Yeah, she's not trying to hurt people.
She's not trying to hurt people. She's not trying to ostracize people. And she's trying to create a world that is believable.
And that's like what is believable for her. Like, you know, she's an author. She can change anything just the way it doesn't have to be so misogynistic. Just the way that like fairies that have different skin tones don't have to be considered brutish or anything like that. And sometimes these are ingrained in us that we don't even realize.
And this is why the editing process is so important. Let me take you back to the fact that Kalias has been under the mountain for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
This army is not his army. This army is Vivian's army that she's built.
And we know Vivian is a badass.
And she's very inclusive. She gets on Kalias all the time for any of his stupid shit that he says. And Farrah comments on the fact that this army is a well-oiled machine. Everybody has a purpose. Everyone is doing it with vigor. And so to me, I read this scene as Feyre being in awe of the inclusivity and the value of every Fey there, whether they be High Fey or Lesser Fey. And the way that it Feyre says, if you exclude the Illyrians, it could have been said differently. It could have been said, after the Illyrians, the Winter Court had the most Lesser Fey.
And you and I were talking about it because I think you said that like you didn't view it the first time like that. And it wasn't until I brought it up. And then I told you that for whatever reason in that moment, I'm half Latina. I heard, if you exclude Hispanics, and I've heard that phrase so many times where I'm like, why are you excluding us? Like, we're people too. And it's just that I think, so that was the thing that stuck out to me. But I agree, it's not a clear moment. It's not super well written. But I loved when you pointed out that this is Vivian's army.
Yeah.
And I will kind of go back to, it is a well-oiled machine, but Feyre also kind of points out, like, they're a little showy too.
Oh.
You know, like, a little fancy, like, gilded cages. I don't know, like, everything just seemed a little fancier.
Yeah.
And so, like, I couldn't tell either. I'm like, are you
happy? Criticizing?
Yeah, like, are you calling them weaker? I don't know what it is. But, yeah, just the section just needed a little bit more work from the editor to make things clear.
And to make it clear that Feyre is not disgusted by, or that the Winter Court is not malicious, or...
Yeah, or the Illyrians aren't other, you know? Like, I don't think Feyre has an issue with the Illyrians. You know, she's not out here having malicious intentions towards them.
This is why you should always get a second, third, fourth opinion on your writing.
Absolutely. Always, always, always have... I think there's like a title for... Insensitivity readers?
I mean, you need cultural insensitivity.
Always.
Checking.
Always. You need someone to check yourself before you wreck yourself.
Exactly. Though Feyre sets about the camp with the intention of talking to Amryn, she stumbles instead across Moore, Vivian's sister, and Briar. I want to suggest here that Moore and Vivian's sister are seen together in a way that links them together romantically. And if that's the case, maybe also foreshadows Moore's coming out to Feyre.
Yep, I have the exact same note. They're definitely hooking up, and at the very least, sexual tension.
And if they're not hooking up yet, they will be.
Oh, they will be.
And here is why. Moore says something to Vivian's sister that makes the sister smile slightly. That smile fades when a male soldier walks past and teases Vivian's sister. At this point, Moore is, quote, watching the female's face carefully and swiftly looks away as the female turned back to Moore. It's totally something I would do with a crush. Maybe I'm reading too much between the lines, but this is such a weird set of details for SJM to deliberately include, especially when we get no mention of Vivian's sister ever again. You can't tell me that this isn't setting up for something down the road.
Absolutely.
I feel like this is particularly relevant since Moore's about to come out to Feyre.
We know that later on, Moore spends a lot of time in the Winter Court in Silver Flames. I thought it was implied that she was out there for a lover, or maybe I made that up in my mind. Either way, we're definitely going to see Moore and the sister together. And the fact that the sister looks almost identical to Vivian, Moore's best friend,
is a little weird.
I just don't know how I'd feel if I had an identical twin. And it was like,
I want to hope that...
And then you went for them?
No. Let's not go there. I'm going to hope that... Or the way I'm going to convince myself this is okay is Moore had a crush on Vivian's sister first and then met Vivian and became friends with Vivian as a way to stay close to Vivian's sister.
All right. I mean, that is better. That is
right?
Better.
It's better.
Yeah. I just... When I read it, I for whatever reason, I was like, my hypothetical twin sister and you ending up together horrified me.
It horrifies me.
Yeah,
that's
like,
weird.
No. it's such a shame because the twin's in love with you, but it'll never happen. How many novels can we, romantic novels can we come up with?
Before the coming out conversation, Moore remarks to Feyre that, quote, "You did a very brave thing in saving Briar. I'm not even sure I would have tried to get her if I would have deemed the risk worth it." I think this piece of the conversation is important for Feyre and Moore so that they're willing to talk to each other later. But more than that, I think that this really shows the value of Feyre's decisions as High Lady, something that's going to have an even bigger impact later this chapter that we're going to get to.
There's a lot that we are about to get into in this section, but I want to point out that Moore takes Feyre to a towering oak tree to reveal her truth. And oak trees represent strength, justice, and honesty, three things that Moore needs for this conversation. Now, as we all know, we were talking about this with our friends last night. I'm the token straight. Unfortunately, I am not a queer woman, so I can't speak too much to Moore's experience. So I'm going to let Amy take it away.
We're at the point in the conversation when Moore comes out to Feyre. There are so many different ways one could look at this, and I chose to prep by looking at it through the Marxist lens. Using the Marxist lens, I'm going to look at the coming out story through the themes of possession, ownership, and silence as forms of power. And I kind of want to relate this back to my own experience of coming out, so bear with me. Moore explains to Feyre that in the Court of Nightmares, queer individuals are reviled and considered selfish. As a possession of her father's, Moore would have been bred like a prize mare, and Kyr would have tied Moore to her marriage bed for Eris if Moore had not sullied herself with Cassian. This is also where we learn that Moore's family nailed a note to her womb after they found out that she had sullied herself. Again, the family has treated Moore's body as a possession and discounts any harm or trauma that might have caused to Moore as an individual. Moore lived her early life as a possession and without ownership of herself. It makes sense then that Moore wishes to keep her sexuality secret so that, quote, "This one thing remains wholly mine, this one part of me. I won't let them destroy it or try to." Moore, in her own way, has found strength, though maybe not complete strength, by owning her sexuality in a way that keeps it secret from others. She owns her sexuality in a way that she decides who gets to know about it and who gets to celebrate that with her. Moore finds power in silence and avoidance. By avoiding talking to Azriel and by walking away from him when he tries to profess his feelings, Moore maintains power over Azriel and over the narrative of her sexuality. And I'm not saying it's right, but that's what Moore felt was right for her, and I can't blame her for that. This is how Moore has chosen to remain in control of her life. I get being in that space 1,000%.
I'm so happy we have you here, obviously. But like, the fact that you're able to interpret this from a different perspective, you know, you're going to get even more into it and I'm going to be more amazed. But already it's completely different than how I originally read it. And it's starting to make more sense. And dare I say, don't make me end up liking her at the end,
Amy. Gosh. Oh, my God. How dare I? Oh. So during prep, I equated the Court of Nightmares to a hyper-religious community.
Yes.
And that feels really contradictory because the Court of Nightmares is the epitome of evil and sexual and...
But yeah, it makes absolute sense. Like, they are highly secluded. They don't really want to mix with anyone else. They're all about their own way of living. And yes, like, you know, we view them as these, like, heathenistic people, but they also have these like super quote unquote traditional ideas
and conservative.
Yeah.
And I feel like I have permission to say this having grown up in a very, very religious community. Mm-hmm. Look at it this way. In religious communities, especially the one I grew up in, they dictate how and when you're allowed to use your body. Men own women, and they won't say that they own women, but men dictate everything. Your value is in your body and your ability to procreate. Mm-hmm. And like you said, they're cut off, they're isolated, or they choose to isolate themselves, and their way of thinking is the only right way of thinking. And having grown up in that system myself, it makes sense that Moore doesn't want to share her sexuality mm-hmm. with the system.
Yeah. I totally get it. And especially like when I was reading through this and there was something that Moore said where it's like, they don't care about people like me, except for the fact that I wouldn't be able to continue kids. And that's like such a cop out reason of like, fuck you guys. Like our value doesn't lay in the ability to have kids or not have kids or wanting to have kids. And then what about, you know, straight women who are in, who aren't able to have kids? You know what I mean? Right. Like we're not one uterus trick ponies.
It's true. And unfortunately, I've been in situations with family members where they have clearly stated our purpose in life is to procreate. And I said, well, fuck that, because even if I was straight, I wasn't going to have children.
Yeah. Amy's busy going to be raising mine.
And I already raised half my siblings. Yes. I don't need to have children. And that's a personal choice. And so I just appreciate what SJM has done here because it really speaks to me and to how I've handled my sexuality throughout the years. And it's not an easy place to be in. And so I do have a lot of sympathy for Moore here and her need to have control because everyone else has controlled her all her life.
Yeah, absolutely. It just, you know, I'm going to rehash the like being pissed off of like our value lays in our ability to have kids or not. And then just the fact that miscarriages are just so, so common in women and that's considered normal and not like, oh, you're like that just happens. Like, and that doesn't even account for trans women and their story. You know, like power doesn't lie in our uterus. Our power lies in
our sparkling personalities.
Fucking sparkly. Just, yeah, our power lies in our, like, you know, just being us, damn it.
Yeah.
Power lies in not being men.
Now, Moore's not perfect, because when you're dealing with this kind of stuff, your head is really messed up, and I totally have been there. And so Moore uses sex as a form of power to manipulate Asriel. I do think that this is only a supplementary tool and a way to distract and disguise what's really going on in her life. Ownership of her sexuality and Moore's silence about it are how she feels like she can control the most important piece of her life. And it's not great for the emotional harm that she causes on Asriel, but I do understand being in that place. There's also this line that I want to discuss that Moore says about Asriel. Quote, I love him enough to want him to find someone who can truly love him like he deserves. And I love myself enough to not want to settle until I find that person too. As much as we really, really rag on Moore and maybe dislike her, Moore deserves love because everybody deserves love. This line really spoke to me in my own experience because, as I said, I grew up in a very strict religion, and accepting my sexuality, despite how I was raised, really calls into question what you're allowed to have and what you think is meant for you in this life. It's very heartbreaking to me when Moore makes it clear she doesn't want to change things because things are good enough. That's a lie a lot of queer people tell themselves when they are not fully out, or at least in my experience, when they're not out and they're trying to make amends with, like, I've got a good life and it's okay that I'm unhappy with this one aspect because at least I have a good life, instead of being like, no, I deserve more.
Yeah,
never settle for good enough.
No, like you're able to, you deserve every single freaking joy in life. Like,
yeah, it's not just for straight people.
No, it's our, damn it, it's our right, like, as humanity, like, to work towards get our ultimate happiness. I will say, when I read this, I had a lot of frustration with Moore and her being like, yeah, I use Asriel and I use him for my own benefit. And, you know, I understand what you're saying. It all makes total sense. I will still say, though, her line of saying, I love him enough to want him to find someone who he can truly love him like he deserves. I still feel like it's a cop out, that one line, because if she did, then she wouldn't keep dragging it along. And I understand everything. It's just and then this is just like accountability, you know, to these fictional characters that aren't real. But it's just like, you know, all of this. And that's what makes a good character and a good complex character, because everything that Amy's talked about can be true and she can still be making the wrong call.
Absolutely. I will 100% tell you without batting an eye, Moore's selfish.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't like the way she's going about it. However, that doesn't mean I don't have empathy for what she's going through.
Mm hmm.
She can be a tragic character, and she is in this respect to me. She can also be a very deeply flawed character, and I don't think she loves Asriel as much as she says she loves Asriel.
Agreed.
He's a safety net for her.
Yeah.
And I'm just really grateful I never had that person.
Yeah, absolutely. Damn it, it makes her a more full character.
It does.
And I will say that, you know, originally at the start of the book and even in past books, we're like, you know, SJM, you just made her the token gay and that's it. Like, you didn't put any thought behind it. And, you know, whether or not she decided more was queer until this book or in the last book, you know, like, who knows? But it makes her more complex and there's a lot of layers to it.
Yeah. And to me, it just shows that SJM did actually put a lot of thought into Moore.
Yeah. And here's a question for you, because Moore leaves for a long time after this mm-hmm. book. How do you think Moore will react, or does she even realize that Asriel has it bad for Elaine later on?
I don't think she knows.
And then how will she react for that?
Who knows?
But you know what it's going to be?
Messy. Feyre ends the exchange with Moore by saying, quote, "I was thinking about how much fun I'm going to have playing matchmaker for you. And this is the most self-aware our messy high lady has ever been, because she has been matchmaking for Nesta and Elaine since chapter 2 of Thorns and Roses and for every female she's ever encountered."
Yeah, absolutely.
When Feyre joins the High Lords in the War Tent, Helion and Asriel reveal that Highburn is on the move to attack the humans below where the wall once stood. When some ask why Highburn has waited this long to march on the humans, Nesta remarks that, quote, "because we insulted him, me and my sisters." Feyre elaborates by explaining, quote, "I killed his priestess. Nesta took his cauldron. And stealing Elaine back was the final insult." And it's as if Elaine's made no contribution, which, yeah, she hasn't, but wow, that's a low blow when Elaine is in the room listening.
I know, right? And Elaine did nothing. You were just a bargaining.
You got kidnapped
and I had to save your ass.
Yeah.
But like, even Feyre's contribution that she references of like killing Ianthe, like the fact that she stole Elaine right back underneath his nose pissed him off way more than Ianthe. I thought we've already established that Ianthe was annoying and no one really liked her.
Yep.
And she wasn't even that powerful. I doubt the king misses her.
I agree. Unless he was banging her. But then even then. Calias makes a comment that's a little silly that I want to read. Quote, "only a madman would have wielded the might of his army just to get revenge on 3 women." Now, that's an asshole thing that Calias would say. And I want to justify what Highburn's done here. We have to remember, Highburn wanted to keep humans as slaves. They went to war over it. They lost. They're going to war over it over again. Humans are beneath the Fae in the minds of the Highburn Fae. So to be bested by former humans and women no less, I'm sure is very, very aggravating for someone as prejudiced and misogynistic as the King of Highburn.
I bet Vivian, who's listening to Clea say this bullshit, is just kind of like, 50 years really made me forget this side of you. Because like, they got married like right away.
Yeah. She didn't like do a test run first.
Yeah. She wasn't like, oh, I forgot about the side of you. Like, you just kind of know, like, okay, all right. I forgot you were this way.
I have at least 1,000 years of kicking this shit out of you.
Yeah. There's a lot of reconditioning that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think because Vivian is amazing and doesn't tolerate the bullshit, we forget that Calias is like this. But I feel like my response would be like, you know, does 3 men make sense? Would that be better for you? Douche. It just goes to show how deeply ingrained the misogyny is here. And at least he looks ashamed when mm-hmm. Vivian just gives him a look. Like, it's just a withering look.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He gets his act together.
I'm going to say that maybe the misogyny is more prevalent in Cleus because he's just bitter because of Amarantha. Doesn't justify it.
I know, but I hope Vivian is just in bed with him being like, would it have made you feel better if it was a man who kept you under the mountain for 50 years?
Yeah. Would it have made you feel better if a man had killed all our younglings?
Yeah. Or is it the woman thing that hurts you more, dear?
You better fucking make me high lady.
Yeah, right? I'm going to downgrade you.
Rhys makes it very clear that even though strategically it may not be sound, he and his allies are going to prioritize keeping the humans safe. Rhys even makes a speech about it not being his mate or his sisters that influence him in this way. Quote, "it is a new world, and we must decide how we are to end this old one and begin it anew. We must decide if we will begin it by allowing those who cannot defend themselves to be slaughtered, if that is the sort of people we are.
This is all very noble, and Rhys is a noble guy. Look what he did for all of Velaris. But I also think that Feyre's dedication to save both her sister and Briar from the Highburn camp have something to do with it. Rhys, just a few chapters ago, made it very clear that Feyre was not to do anything but save Elaine. Yet Feyre went above and beyond to save both Elaine and another human. Feyre is going to suggest a similar thing very soon, and by doing so, Feyre sets the example that despite the odds and the risk to self and loved ones, it's worth going the extra mile to save more than those intended.
In many ways, Feyre is a reminder to the Court of Dreams of what it means to strive to be good. I'm not saying Feyre is a saint, but she hasn't been tainted with 500 years of war in history. She's reminded Rhys to protect the helpless, and she's also reminded Mor to find strength in her truth. But I love the sentiment. What kind of people do we want to be? What's the legacy? Now that I'm saying this out loud, I'm appreciating it even more when you think about how several times in this book, they're like, we're better than everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was that moment at the very beginning when Mor was like, should we have tried harder?
Yeah.
With Highburn? And I like to imagine that all of it's kind of come back in their face. And Rhys isn't just saying this to the other High Lords, but to himself too, being like, Hey, even we screwed up.
Yeah, I think so too. Because if you think about it, Rhys has only ever protected Velaris.
Yeah.
Because that's where his family is.
Yep.
He had to sacrifice a lot of people in the Night Court when Amarantha took over.
Yep.
And so Rhys could choose, you know what? Velaris is all that matters. And the humans aren't my humans. I have my humans safe. You know, like they're already with me.
Yeah. Like, I mean, Velaris is just one city. And we already know the Night Court is one of the biggest territories.
Right.
Like, it's not just Velaris and a couple of like Illyrian camps. I'm sure there's other really big cities there, too, that maybe it wasn't specified that it was destroyed by Amarantha. But you can guess like even the fact that he didn't go and protect them.
Yeah. Yeah. And think about the fact that there were temples in Sangreval and all these places where I'm sure there were also people who were then under Amarantha's control.
I forgot Sangreval is part of the Night Court, huh?
Yeah. And they're, I think
so it did get raided.
Yeah, it did.
Damn it. I'm mad. But Cassian, our emotionally intelligent king, says it perfectly. And I would like to argue that Cassian never needed the reminder from Feyre because he's always been perfect.
I agree.
Quote, if I ended my life defending those who need it most, then I will consider it a death well spent. And then he says that right after looking at Nesta.
And it's a callback to what he said back in Mist and Fury.
It's like, oh, did someone hear that noise? Those my panties just dropped.
Feyre then makes her bold suggestion that everyone who can winnow should help get humans out of the path of Highburn and take them to safety. Feyre suggests this, knowing that it will worsen hers and everyone around her chances of survival. When there's resistance, Feyre remarks, quote, one life may change the world. Where would you all be if someone had deemed saving my life to be a waste of time? It's the best smackdown in history, but also the same can be said of Tamlin. Think about it. If it weren't for him, Feyre would be dead right now. They need Feyre to do all the cauldron stuff later on in this novel. Also, although Rhys is the one who saved Feyre under the mountain, Tamlin's the one who brought her to Prithian.
Yeah. None of this would have happened without Tamlin either.
It's true.
Yeah.
I wonder also, could the same be said to Briar? Because why else is she here and saved and has a name?
I love how we're so suspicious. Like, I'm sorry, you have a name.
You have a name.
You have a name.
And it's not Thomas Mandre. She doesn't have a second name.
No, just a name.
Just a name.
We don't trust that here.
No, we don't.
It is the best smackdown, you know, genuinely. Now, if I was one of those humans who was saved and I heard this, my anxiety would skyrocket because I feel like I'd have to live up to the potential. And it's like one time in my 20s, my mom told me, like, you're my greatest achievement or like you're the best thing I've ever done. And I burst into tears because I was like, I didn't even do anything. I'm a waste. I'm sorry. I didn't do better. Like, and, you know, and she was like, what the hell? Like, you graduated with your master's. You did things. Like, not that that's like, you know, the end all be all or anything like that. But it just was like, just the sentiment of like, your life is worth more like for me or something. It just like freaked me out.
Yeah.
I've since accepted it. Therapy. But
yeah. What does it say about us when we're like, I am not worthy to be alive if for you to think that I'm the greatest thing that you've ever created. Whereas it could be, wow, you haven't done a lot in your life if you think I'm the greatest thing you've created.
Tell that to my mom.
No, I do not. Good thing she doesn't listen to the main episodes.
Well, you know, I'm going to agree. Like, I think I'm pretty great. But, you know, I accept it now. I think it's just that idea of like, and it's the same thing, like one person can change history. And it's like, shit, that's what I need to do now.
I need to change history.
I need to change history. Like, I need to change my sheets. You know, like, I'm just working on that right now. I can't change history with my sheets need to be cleaned.
Amryn interrupts the scene by stating all the remade women need to get to the cauldron to help stop the Hybern army. And all I can think is, girl power.
Girl power. Equality of the sexes. Spice World.
I
know, no, but I'm talking to the
audience.
Our audience, who is like 50% under an age that would understand that.
Yeah, fair.
We learn the plan to use Amryn's spell from the Book of Breathings at the start of Chapter 67. It's all told indirectly, a summary of whatever Amryn may have said. What I think is brilliant about this, from a writing perspective, is the fact that because it's told as a summary, we don't know what Amryn actually said and what Feyre has potentially misinterpreted. It makes Amryn's deception harder to detect as readers, which makes Amryn's quote-unquote betrayal later on a greater surprise, which is tricky, tricky, Astraean.
And to do this in the same chapter that just screams, hey guys, Rhys is going to die. Like, Astraean is yelling it at us.
Yeah. It's evil. But so good.
So good.
Feyre and Rhys work together to try to coax humans from her village to go to the Summer Court, away from Hybern's impending path of destruction. Rhys, all the while, uses his Daemati powers to, quote, hold their minds gently, soothing them, as I explained. Though it's enough to work on the first family, it's not enough to calm the panic of the second family. First of all, I feel like the mind tricks are already questionable. It's even worse that Rhys takes the resistant families against their will. To me, it's an issue of consent. I know in the end, it may be for their ultimate good, but who's Rhys to decide that for them? I personally think he does it because he knows that if he doesn't force the humans, it will eat Feyre alive.
You and I had a really long talk during prep on this.
Yes, we did.
And we discovered that we're two different people sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes, you know, I question if I'm a villain. And in my mind, I'm actually frustrated that Rhys didn't go harder and enchant them all. Like, just the fact that this entire thing, I agree he's doing for Feyre, but what I think he's doing for Feyre is the asking people, going door to door, saying like, hey guys, you need to pack up, we gotta go. I have no doubt he could have easily just landed in the city square, put out some kind of enchantment and be like, all right, everyone gather up, gather around, we're leaving. Like, there, no one gets a say. And, you know, we went back and forth quite a bit on where's the morality in that. You know, Feyre says they weren't able to get everyone. Like, they did a good job, but how many lives were killed because they had to go door to door? Because there were some people who are there trying to convince.
Yeah, because they were trying to get consent.
Yeah, because they were trying to get consent. Basically, Feyre is the problem for this one for me. It's like, no, we could have made more questionable choices here, saved more people.
And this is where you and I diverge. And that's okay.
It's okay. It's okay. I just, you know, sometimes I'm really happy that I'm not a character in a fantasy book because I don't think I'd be the hero.
I don't. With all the way you make decisions.
Yeah. And I wouldn't start the villain, but it'd be that side character. I'm no side character, but it would be the character that descends, definitely. Mm-hmm. And I accept that. I don't know if I'm the character that redeems, though.
What this all reminds me, though, is that Rhys isn't perfect. None of these characters are perfect. And from my view, the decision to take people without their consent is a reminder that there is a side of Rhys that lurks behind Feyre's unreliable narrative, and it's the Rhys that we see in Silver Flames.
I agree, especially where it's like, you know, this is him trying to be morally good by not going full on, because historically Rhys has made more larger moves to save large amounts of people,
yep.
Which makes it more more questionable.
Yep.
And he's not doing that. And that is solely for Feyre's sake. And he's a morally gray guy.
Hence Silver Flames.
Silver Flames.
Feyre and Rhys, along with the other High Fae who can winnow, work through the night to bring humans to safety. Quote, until we were panting, until even Rhys's strength flagged and he could barely winnow back to our tent. Too much strain, too much relying on his power. We're meant to feel this exhaustion and desperation. SJM is doing this to us so that we feel concerned that her heroes may not win and may not live. And I have to point it out because there's no other way SJM can make the stakes high.
Yeah. Yeah. And as Feyre watches Rhys sleep, she knows that there will be a lot of death on the battlefield and that Rhys will be the first to sacrifice himself in order to try to prevent harm to his friends and family. Quote, I watched him sleep, counting his breaths. We knew that we wouldn't walk away from that battlefield. SJM just told us that Rhys isn't going to live, and yet we forget so quickly, and it's still going to be a surprise when it comes, and I still cry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we all do. Mm-hmm. The inevitability of the final battle turns up the heat for everybody, but especially for Feyre. Quote, I wouldn't let him do it. Wouldn't let Rhys sacrifice himself, not without trying myself. I didn't care about the cost or the risk, not as I looked at my sleeping mate, exhaustion lining his face. He had given enough. This is the moment, after hundreds of pages, when Feyre decides that the risk of the Ouroboros is worth it. I don't think any of us, by this point, doubt the necessity of the decision and her willingness to see it through. There's been a lot of buildup to get to here. The question is, do we think Feyre is ready?
It makes sense. Feyre just said that she knows Rhys is going to die, and Feyre has come to understand a lot of things about herself, about what she did to the people at the Spring Court, her ego, all of it, and I'm about to get a little bit more into it.
Before then, one visual thing I want to point out. When Feyre and Amryn went to see Bryaxis earlier this novel, they descended into an impenetrable dark. Here in the Court of Nightmares, as Feyre prepares to see the Ouroboros, she, quote, peers up into the impenetrable gloom. We're getting some impenetrable darkness mirrors here, if you will. Through one side, Feyre has bound herself to Bryaxis, and through the other, she will gain the means to bind herself to the Carver. And I just thought it was a nice touch.
It is. Before we start chapter 68, when Feyre goes to get the Ouroboros, I want to point out something. Since the first episode of the season, we have dragged Feyre, and we've had many comments of people saying, damn, she's really getting it this season. Well, we had to point out every step she went too far, every time she strayed from who she is at her core, every wrong decision. It was all for this moment. See, SJM wanted Feyre to be far away from her morals and her character. She needed Feyre to be so out of line with who she truly is because this moment needed to mean something. If human Feyre from Thorns and Roses, who was innocent of major sin, aka like murder and death, had faced the mirror, or even Mist and Fury Feyre, who was so consumed with self-hatred, had faced the mirror, it wouldn't have meant the same thing. Feyre had to be humbled in this book. She had to step away from her morals, and she had her big old ego at the start of this book. She's developed and healed this entire time to finally be able to be worthy to get the Ouroboros. So when we go through this and wonder if it makes sense for Feyre to be here, for Feyre to get this mirror, just remember that we did 18 episodes to get here.
I love that you bring this up because it has been a freaking long journey for Feyre. Mm-hmm. And the reason why it's been a freaking long journey is because at her core, she knows she done fucked up.
Yes.
She would not have survived the Ouroboros had she shown up any sooner than this moment.
And for SJM, as a writer, was trying to show us that Feyre is fucked up. She was trying to show us at the start of this book where normally, as first-time readers, me included, I was like, get it, girl, bring down the Spring Court, right?
Right.
Having Ianthe smash her own hand, having to do, you know, all these like sneaky moves over there, getting that soldier whipped. All of these things aren't good for Feyre. Like all of these like little moves, like she was never truly herself. And we kept pointing it out for a reason, guys. Remember, we tear down characters to build them back up.
And we've finally gotten to the point where Feyre has been built back up.
Yeah. I just hope that there's at least one person out there who's listening that's like,
wow.
Like, they did it on purpose.
It came full circle.
Full
circle. Like the Ouroboros.
Like, some would say, like a serpent biting its own tail.
Like the Ouroboros.
I was about to say the tail biting its own head.
As Feyre enters the Ouroboros' chamber in chapter 68, Feyre sees snow and moonlight.
Let's go back to chapter one of Thorns and Roses. There was snow the night she killed Andras in Thorns and Roses, and there was moonlight, just like there's moonlight everywhere. That's a visual representation of Rhys. The wind outside is, quote, howling through the cracks like wolves, like the same wolves Feyre was afraid to encounter at the start of Thorns and Roses. It's such an amazing parallel to the start of the series. A mirror, you might say. I don't think that it's a coincidence when you know Feyre is here to look in a mirror. We're about to really sense and understand just how far she's come despite the similarities to the beginning.
I bet the chamber is kind of a bone carver situation where the chamber itself appears differently for every person. So for Feyre, it was kind of her darkest time when she was human, when she was starving, you know, the snow and the wolves and the darkness. That's kind of how we first saw her. And, you know, for me, it would be a extremely hot and sunny day where there's not even a breeze. And it's just like, I'm just really uncomfortable. There's no shade. I have to walk.
And just keep
the
going.
Mirror is just really far away.
The chamber and the mirror itself contain contradictions, just like Feyre, the Weaver, the Cauldron, and the Book of Breathings throughout this series. Snow both glitters on the walls and slithers over Feyre's boots. The Ouroboros itself is a snake eating its own tail, a symbol of both beginning and ending. The mirror is both black as night and wholly clear. Feyre's hands burn with cold. She's both alone and not alone. All of this creates a sense of foreboding in the reader, adding to the dread we felt in the last chapter about Rhys dying, but also, is Feyre going to survive? Let's also not look over this description. Quote, moonlight peered in, bathing the entire chamber in blues and silvers. Earlier in this book, we saw a lot of bathing scenes for Feyre, but we argued that she was never really cleaned from her sins. And I think here with the moonlight, with Rhys bathing Feyre, Feyre's finally getting that true baptismal clean as she prepares to look at her true self.
It's so true. I love that. I love that note so much.
When the beast appears in the mirror's reflection, Feyre sees that it has, quote, claws and scales and fur and shredding teeth, the fur on them a blend of black and gold, not a beast designed to hunt in these mountains, certainly not with the ridge of dark scales down its back. We know that this beast is ultimately Feyre's inner monster because those blue-gray eyes are a dead giveaway. It is curious, though, how it's a hodgepodge of things. Fur and scales, black and gold, as if it's a blend of all the High Lord's beasts. Because remember, Tamlin's form has gold fur, Helion is also gold, Rhys is black.
I thought so too, but I think the link is really there for Tamlin and what the gold now represents for Feyre. Because Feyre has accepted those similarities that we kind of had with her and Tamlin at the beginning. And I kind of want to look at it as she's always had an easier time accepting her own darkness. Mm-hmm. And now it's almost like she's struggling to accept the good, the gold, potentially.
Yeah, I definitely see the black and gold as good and bad.
Yeah.
Here's another parallel to the first chapter in Thorns and Roses. Feyre appears first in her humanoid form in the mirror before her reflection becomes the monster. It is not unlike chapter one of Thorns and Roses when Feyre the Doe is confronted with a monster like Andras in wolf form. Feyre ultimately returns to the Bone Carver, where she learns her retrieval of the Ouroboros was nothing more than a test. Feyre is furious. Quote, rage, blistering rage, started to fill in the holes left by what I'd beheld in the mirror. But this is where we see Feyre's growth. Instead of acting out like she did at the start of Wings and Ruin, when she sought revenge against Tamlin, Feyre remains calm, intent on utilizing the Bone Carver despite his deception, because saving Rhys is more important than her anger at the Bone Carver. And that's our High Lady for you.
I know this, what I'm about to say, should be probably left for the breadcrumbs, but I'm going to say it here. And if you're not caught up in the SJM verse, just, you know, step away, please. All right. You're still here. Feyre now controls the mirror. She shows up to the Bone Carver and she's this like, she summons it and it shows up wherever she wields it. That is 100% going to be used in Crescent City 3. Yep. I have no doubt about that.
100%.
And then when Feyre is talking to the bone carver, she says, quote, I was wrung dry, my soul new and trembling. I'm going to throw this out there, but when Bryce was going between worlds, she said that she didn't want to leave her body. I saw a Happy Hermit was the one who pointed out this quote, so I don't want to pretend like I remembered it. But the fact that Bryce says she doesn't want to leave her body, it was as if there's another body for her to return to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And finally, the bone carver tells Feyre that he had little need of the mirror, but she did. Crescent City 3.
Yeah, why else would this conveniently be available for her to summon anytime she wants?
Right.
The day of the final battle arrives in Chapter 69. Hybern has destroyed Feyre's old village and many of the human territories in his path. Note how only one third of the former Archeron estate remains standing. I want to suggest that this represents the Archeron sisters and where they'll be by the end of the novel. Feyre, who's accepted herself and her fey life, will remain standing. Elaine and Nesta, however, will not be, not in the same way as Feyre. This is emphasized by the fact that, quote, Elaine's garden was trampled, and that proud oak where Nesta had liked to stand in the shade, it had been burned into a skeletal husk, not unlike the skeletal husk that Nesta will be in Frost and Starlight.
Yep. Well, earlier we had Mor bearing her truth under an oak tree. We see that Nesta's oak tree has burned away, even more foreshadowing mm-hmm. for silver flames.
I think so.
While Feyre and Nesta wear Illyrian leathers, Elaine decides to wear winter court armors because it was just oh so scandalous. This shows to me that Feyre and Nesta were meant to be a unit. And spoiler verse, I hope that means though one day that we're going to see Feyre and Nesta fight together next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
How great would that be? Sister and sister.
That'd be great.
Fighting together. On the other hand, Elaine is horrified at how scandalous the leathers are and would rather suffer additional heat. Like
additional layers.
Additional layers.
Jack's nightmare.
Yeah. Like the leathers are already hot and now you're going to use fur boots and a fur jacket. No. All of this is Silver Flames foreshadowing. Nesta is next in the storyline. Elaine is not ready to go there. Even at the sight of the knife that Cassian offers Elaine, she gets into a tizzy. Okay, maybe not a tizzy, but she goes all white at the sight of it. And, like, suck it up, Elaine.
And it's just further imagery and proof that Elaine hasn't accepted her frightness.
No. I sleep with a blade next to my bed.
You do.
A Gurkha blade.
You do. When Elaine refuses to take the knife that Cassian offers her, Asriel steps in and gives Elaine Truth Teller, informing her that, quote, I won't be using it today, so I want you to. Asriel forces Truth Teller into Elaine's hands, and he's gentle about it, but I question consent here again. But when Asriel tells Elaine that Truth Teller always strikes true, that is just 100% foreshadowing in my mind that Elaine's going to use it.
Sorry, like, come on, Navy. Truth Teller represents his penis. It strikes true every time.
I was about to make that same joke. When we learn that Asriel has never let Truth Teller be touched by anybody else, that was totally a penis joke in my head.
Oh, I didn't even think about that one either. I was just thinking the strike true. The whole thing, we should just reread the whole thing and just say penis.
Honestly, though, penis jokes everywhere.
Penis jokes everywhere. Like, you're saying he forces it in her hand?
Like a lack of consent.
Yeah.
The strikes
whole thing,
true.
The whole thing.
Whole thing. Now, the significance of Asriel giving Elaine Truth Teller does more than just show Asriel's feelings for Elaine, but again foreshadows the role that the blade will play in the upcoming battle.
What's important, though, is that even though Asriel is giving her his sword, I think SJM makes a point to show that it's not meant for Elaine. Quote, the midday sun devoured by the dark blade. Even Feyre's painting that she has in her head shows that they're not meant to mesh.
What is Jack referring to? Something that hurts my soul. When Feyre imagines a painting of Elaine and Asriel as a lovely fawn and death, quote, light and dark, the space between their bodies a blend of the two, the only bridge of connection, that knife. Now, my soul wants Elaine and Asriel to be together because it's so problematic I just would eat it up. But pay attention to the wording SJM uses in this section. The only bridge of connection is the knife. Metaphorically speaking, we could also say that the only connection Elaine and Asriel share is their trauma bond. And so, really, though I love the idea of light and dark together, I don't think they're meant to be.
And you think about like their only connection, their link is like metaphorically the blade. That metaphorically, not metaphorically, but it kills. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, that's not a great foundation to be linked to another person. It's something that's meant to represent, to bring death.
Right.
It's not even hands holding, you know, like it's a deadly blade.
It's not even kissing.
No, it's not meant to be, guys.
I wish I could find a similarity between Elaine and Asriel and Feyre and Rhys with this picture, because you could say that they're light and dark. Is, you know, her starfall gown and he's knight triumphant, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But I'm struggling.
Yeah. I mean, especially since when Feyre wears her star gown, she says she would never shine as bright without the dark of the sky.
Yeah.
And even in her brightness, she shines because of Rhys.
Yeah.
Versus Asriel devours.
Yeah, I know.
I know. It's so long painful. As we get a scene where he does devour.
Yeah. They don't have to be together. I just want some sex.
Same. I don't care. I just want that scene, damn it.
Feyre realizes she used her last night with Rhys to face the Ouroboros and make her bargain with the Carver. And though Feyre laments that she did not get to have a last night with Rhys, what I love about this is that Feyre ultimately chose herself on what she assumes is her last night alive and walked away not only seeing her true self, but loving her full self as well. Also, Rhys offers a last-minute tussle in the back of a wagon, as per usual, and it's nice to see that even in dire circumstances, Rhys is still able to wield talk of sex to comfort Feyre, but I really wish it had happened.
Yeah, you and I were talking about this. We're like, both of us were like, yeah, no, we got 5 minutes. We can schedule that. Like,
give us a quickie.
They should have done it. They should have done it. The inner circle gathers together for one last conversation where Rhys thanks each of them for being in his life. It made me cry while reading this. It made me cry while doing my notes. When asked which speech they want, he says, do they want the inspiring one or the bleak one? And Amron says, the real one. He then goes one by one to his friends and how they've changed his life for the better. When it gets to Feyre, I'm always wrecked, and it's an iconic line and I just have to read it. Quote, I would have waited 500 more years for you, 1,000 years. And if that was all the time we were allowed to have, the wait was worth it. And then my heart destroys. And I just love on TikTok, people point out like Rhys says that while Tamlin said, your hair's clean. And it just makes me think, Taylor Swift, of course, isn't it just so pretty to think that all along there was some invisible string tying you to me? There's a reason why Rhys isn't talking about what they have to lose, that they're so strong and that they're going to get through this. His message to them instead is clear, quote, we will fight for life, for survival, for our futures. But if it is the tapestry of fate or the cauldron or the mother that we do not walk off that field today, the great joy and honor of my life has been to know you. This is Rhys's goodbye. He's telling them to fight, to live, not to fight, to win. He says the fight is to live, for survival, for future. And I just really want to make that distinction, that he's not saying that they have to win. And it's an important distinction, one that we don't catch at first, because it's more important to him for his loved ones to walk off that battlefield.
Yep. And it's sad because he's not included in that statement.
Yeah.
Did you notice that as the group gathers, Feyre observes this, quote, Rhys stared at all of us, somehow assembled here in the sun-drenched open grasses, without being given the order. What does the sun represent in battle? Victory. And so despite this sadness and all the last night, last time seeing each other stuff, we're getting the visual cues that our heroes will win the day despite the odds.
Why am I so sad? Like this whole scene, this whole chapter, this whole end of the book. I've read it so many times and it makes me sad. And it's just because SJM's a good writer and focuses on the characters.
That's right. We are finally ready for the showdown with Highburn. Though Jack and I are not going to get into the meat of the battle this episode, I do want to say it's hilarious to me that the first part of the battle is all just magical shields trying to best each other, especially because Amron says, quote, I forgot how boring this part is. And I don't blame her. It just is such a male thing.
Right. It's just like Ben being stupid.
Yeah. Feyre finally reveals what she's been keeping secret, the presence of Bryaxis and the Carver in the front of the army, her mating gift to Rhys. It is here we get some detail previously kept from us readers about Feyre's experience looking at the Ouroboros. I used to think it was a cop-out for SJM to not write that scene and keep it in the present. However, having analyzed Wings and Ruin, I now think the placement makes sense. Like the more intimate moments Feyre and Rhys have shared in this novel, Feyre's experience with the Ouroboros is told to us as a flashback.
I agree. Feyre doesn't share the super intimate moments with the reader. They are either flashbacks or summary. And it used to bug me, but now it makes perfect sense. And it just, consistency as a writer.
Yeah, she's being consistent.
Mm-hmm.
The whole Ouroboros scene is deeply personal for Feyre. It was difficult for her to get through, but more than that, because she faced herself, quote, every horrific, cruel, and selfish thing, the pride and the hypocrisy and the shame, Feyre is now capable of loving herself fully, even in the dark and ugly parts. And the fact that Feyre is not even willing to let Rhys see that memory is very telling of how important it is to her, so of course, we only get to see it in the past tense.
And, you know, I just throwing in some last minute things here, guys, I recognize Ianthe's tattoo that was on her forehead, the moon phases, now is on Feyre's back. And I do think it means something, especially since Feyre's killed Ianthe and she's faced her inner demons. Also, if I was Cassian, I would have been pissed that the High Lord and the High Lady did not talk to me about their death gods helping out for this battle. Like, maybe he wanted to strategize a little bit differently.
Agreed. That was very selfish of them.
It's like, they were just doing it for the shock and awe. They're meant to be together.
Yeah. Ugh. And now time for some breadcrumbs. As per usual, we do have some SJM verse breadcrumbs in here. So skip ahead or listen at your own peril. In chapter 66, in the Winter Court camp, quote, white foxes scuttled about underfoot, bearing what looked to be messages strapped to their little embroidered vests, just like the otters in Crescent City.
I love it. It's cute.
It's so cute.
When Amran will not let Feyre into her tent, quote, whatever the Suriel had told me to suggest to her about the book, she deemed it more vital, it seemed, than even why I'd come to speak to her, to join me in retrieving Bryaxis. Because Amran finally found the spell to set her free.
Also in chapter 66, when Amran says she found a spell to use on the cauldron, quote, I found a way to stop his entire army. What Amran doesn't say is that it's Amran in her true form that will stop the entire army.
In chapter 69, when Rhysand says his final thank yous to the inner circle, he looks at Nesta and Elaine and says, we have not known each other for long, but I have to believe that you were brought here into our family for a reason, too. And maybe today we'll find out. And just like how Feyre was the fortune teller back in book two, so is Rhys. Because sure enough, in that same day, Elaine and Nesta will kill the king of Highburn.
At the end of Rhys's speech to the inner circle, Amran says, quote, we are grateful, Rhysand, more than you know. This, along with Amran waiting in expectation for Rhys to say nice things about her, tells me Amran was feeling guilty / knows this is a final farewell.
Yep.
Going back to the question at the start of the episode, how are the truths revealed in this section influencing the reader?
Oh, it's all the influence. When you think about it, we know no one's going to die, like, for real. Even as you're reading it, you kind of have a hunch, like, SJM's not going to screw us over. And I've read this so many times, but it just makes everything so high stakes. And the reason why is because every character feels so real.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not just these two-dimensional beings anymore. Even more. Like, there's so many truths that are coming out right now that is what influences us as a reader to feel high stakes. Because even though it's not actually high stakes and we know everyone's going to be okay, it still feels super tense.
Yeah, I agree. There's a reason why the two most annoying characters in this novel, Mor and Tamlin, have had the truth revealed at this point.
Yep.
It's because we are meant to feel their desperation, that they need to reveal their truth because they are so desperate because they're not sure they're going to live either.
Yeah.
And the desperation really, as you said, fuels our belief that though we know things will be okay, our emotions are telling us otherwise.
We're getting emotionally gut punched left and right here. Like, it's just been a constant stress of, like, we know where they're going to be fine. But I'm all over the place here. I've already cried multiple times doing these notes.
Oh, absolutely.
And we haven't even got to Papa Archeron. We haven't even gotten to the Rhys part of it yet. Like, I don't look forward to that.
Yeah, that's next episode.
And we have... What?
Papa Artron or Anne Rhys?
Yeah.
In one episode.
In one episode.
What? Can you see the, like,
I can see the terror on your face. Flabbergasted.
What even is the last episode then? Just the recap, like the wind down?
Yeah.
My stomach just dropped. I don't look forward to next week having to record that.
Genuinely, we think this is the worst of it before we get to those points.
Yeah.
We think, like, this is sad and the stakes are high, but it's all going to be okay. And this is the worst I could feel at this moment, right?
Yeah.
It's not going to get worse than this, right?
Right? Nope. I'm still processing that we're doing Papa Artron and Rhys's death in the same episode. Past us did not have any sympathy for current us.
Nope.
All right. Well, I hope everyone has a week to gather themselves. Do you think we're going to cry during the episode recording? No.
No.
Do you think I will?
No.
Oh.
I think we're going to cry during
reading.
Yeah, reading and taking notes.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Get ready.
Stress now.
And now this week's feature review from Apple Podcasts.
This review is from Katie, titled Love. I love Amy and Jack. I love listening to their points of view and opinions on things I would have never thought of. These books are so good, but having this extra discussion is just chef's kiss. I hope they don't only do ACOTAR. I'd love to hear more about different series once this series is done.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Katie. We're so excited for the journey we're going to go on.
Because we're about to go on a journey.
We sure are. And we hope you all stick around for it because we're really excited for where we're going. And we hope you are, too.
Yeah. And at the very least, just put us on in the background and mute it.
Or just like really low.
Just like really low. That's fine.
If you like your review read on the podcast, please go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star written review. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. Next week, we'll be exploring chapters 70 through 77 of A Court of Wings and Ruin.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com for a chance to have your feedback discussed during a weekly mini episode.
If you are enjoying the podcast, please visit our website, booktalkforbooktalk.com, to view our latest merch and learn about supporting the show through Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Venmo. You can also follow us on TikTok or Instagram at the handle booktalkforbooktalk.
Bye!